Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/campaign to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
In this episode, Tony Russo, CFO at Imply, explains why company values play a pivotal role in evaluating new opportunities. He emphasizes the importance of finance staying lean, and he describes why operational discipline is so critical to success. Hi, I'm Ross, and this is the CFO Playbook, where each week you'll get insights from world-class financial leaders to help you grow your company, yourself, and face the challenges required of today's CFO. Tony, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Ross.
And Tony, you've been in finance and you've actually been a CFO for a long time, almost 25 years, in fact, over 25 years that you've been in the roles of either CFO or Chief Operating Officer. And one of the themes that we love to explore here is the role of finance, the role of CFO, and how that's been changing over time. How have you seen that change from the point of which you first took on the role to you now in maybe like your seventh, eighth, ninth position as CFO at the other end of the scale?
From my perspective, I've often joined the companies that I've been at roughly the same stage, kind of Series B stage companies. Usually I come in after a round of investment has been raised. More often than not, I've come in as an operational CFO. Sometimes I had the COO title, but it's often been a placeholder till we can hire some other operational folks and I flip back to the CFO title. But it's been pretty consistently, in my case, an operational CFO, meaning that in addition to the kind of standard functions, if you will, like finance and accounting, FP&A and some other things, oftentimes I'll come in and have responsibility for HR, building out that function. Sales operations is another one, facilities. In some cases, I've filled the role of running customer success until we can build that out. So I tend to be an operating partner to the founding team. That's been pretty consistent. What's changed is over time, the scope of the initial footprint is kind of narrowed a bit. So for example, it's been quite some time before I've basically come in and run customer success. So it seems like companies are building out these other functions sooner now, which is really great because, you know, I give myself like a B+ in CS and, you know, I can help hire out and build out the function and certainly the reporting and the data analytics that go behind it, I'm comfortable with. But I think a lot of times the founding team are using the Series A or maybe even Series B money to build out some of these other functions. Sales operations is a function that I've been very involved with almost since the get-go. And in fact, that's one too where it's changed a bit such that it's now more common for me to see the CRO or the head of sales have sales operations. And I'm now a heavy dotted line into that function as opposed to a direct reporting relationship. So I think overall, it's been more of a shift of focusing more on reporting and understanding business operations. So that, I guess that's another change, which is, it seems to me now that I'm running across more companies where the business operations function is getting started sooner, and that's come under me. So that's a function that the CFO, my role as the CFO has had in recent experience and also at Imply. And so literally building out that function at this stage is a bit of a change. It seems like things are happening sooner, right? When I think about how startups have evolved, they're raising more money, they're building out these other functions sooner. I play a role in building out the other functions, but I'm handing them off or not having direct responsibility for those sooner, which is actually great because you need that to scale.
And you mentioned that the companies you join typically have been for a long while at a similar stage, that Series B. So what is it that draws you to that magical stage where you've got product market fit, but you're not IPO'd yet?
I love those challenges. So I love coming into situations where there's product market fit and there's capital and it's about scaling, right? So I like to scale and build great teams and build great companies and kit them out and take things to the next stage. And I've been, you know, when I started my career 20, 25 years ago, this wasn't some grand scheme, right? I got involved with some Series A stage companies earlier, and then we managed to have some decent outcomes where they would get to kind of what I would call a Series B or maybe Series C stage. The result of that was I built some relationships, in particular with a law firm here in the Valley, Gunderson Dettmer, which is a fantastic law firm. And they have been a pipeline for work for me because they typically get involved with Series B stage companies and also with a couple of CEOs that I work with repeatedly that come in around the same time. So we kind of fell into this operational toolkit to scale, help founders scale companies. So I did that for quite some time and that's been great. That's been a very good fit for me. The juice to what I do is the operating stuff. The finance stuff, I'm great. I was a math major and I like numbers and I love spreadsheets and all that stuff. But what I really like is translating ops into numbers and metrics and dashboards and really giving guidance where I can to the senior team and the founding team on not just what did happen, but what, you know, forecast what could happen, run scenarios, run sensitivities. And also something else that I should mention, legal is often a huge part of my role. I'm very fortunate to have a great general counsel here at Imply, so it's less so here, but at many, many companies at every other company at that stage, I've had to basically be 25% legal and get involved with that, which is great. And I enjoy negotiating, but I think that's another change too, where I think companies at this stage might be getting into VP legal, general counsel earlier than might have happened in the past.
And I like that, the point where you alluded to of the enjoying negotiating. I wonder if that is like a very common trait within CFOs, because I've seen our own CFO do it and he was masterful at it. It was great. I almost was sad that he wasn't leading some of our sales negotiations, because he would have been brilliant at it. Is that something that you were always a natural at, or did you have to hone that skill?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a natural ability there. I also enjoy it. I generally try to find win-wins. So that's good. That tends to work well. I love assisting salespeople close deals. I mean, that's you got to grow, you got to book deals, right? I mean, bookings is cliche, but bookings does solve pretty much every problem except HR problems. And so I really enjoy that. And I can be, you know, the bad cop when I need to be. But I also, what I really like is creative solutions to get things done, right? Like, okay, we're at an impact. How do we get creative around this? And so that's why, you know, I've sold a number of companies and I enjoy that process. I really enjoy diligence and integration once you've built a great company to kind of figure out. And you need to negotiate as part of that. You also need to problem solve as part of that and map. When I come into a company, I always think about what's it going to look like? Are we going to be ready to sell or IPO, right? So I try to start instrumenting things with that in mind from the beginning, and kind of develop a 2 to 3 year plan to get there. And sometimes it happens sooner, but having that in mind is good. And so when you said negotiation, I thought about sales. I also think about negotiating offer letters, especially with senior folks, particularly helping them understand the value of the options that they're getting, right? And I enjoy that too. For me, you know, again, the account, I've closed books, I love accounting, it's gotta be solid. We get audits, we pass them, all that stuff is great, but it's this stuff that really, really helped me find some of these operational opportunities and kind of suss out what would I be doing at the companies. Like, you know, figuring out, okay, what exactly is my role going to be? What value can I bring? What are the gaps that I see that they have in terms of where they can scale? Where are they going to need help to scale? That sort of thing.
And this is what is something I was going to touch on when you mentioned like trying to prepare for exit, so IPO or acquisition. I'd imagine you've got some type of checklist in your mind that you at least you're trying to work through. What are the top things that you look for on that checklist that you're trying to help the company prepare for that scale?
Yeah, so diligence readiness, right? I call that diligence readiness. And it starts with, do we have repositories? Are they organized, right? Repositories by essentially a diligence request list. Like, having sold a number of companies, these request lists are fairly standard and they're fairly extensive. And so one of the things we do is build a data room. As we run the business, we're populating a data room with our contracts, with our employment agreements, with our PAIAs, all this other stuff, with our IP. Two is making sure that our policies and procedures are aligned with what you might expect a large acquirer to want to see. So a bookings policy, HR policies, accounting policies, even like around allocations and things like that. Just thinking about, what is it going to look like in a couple of years if a big company like Salesforce or something, or Adobe, huge company that has diligence, they're great at acquiring companies. What is it going to look like to them? Right. And having worked with, like, we sold a company to Adobe, I've been through that diligence process, and I can take that experience and go, okay, so this is what it was like to, you know, to sit across the table and go through it. Because when you sell a company, you've got to be ready, because the speed of getting through diligence is super important. Time will kill deals, so you want to get it done fast. Yeah, running a clean ship is really important. You don't want to have to disclose too many things. There's something called a schedule of exceptions when you sell a company that goes with the merger agreement. That's where you're calling out things that kind of are out of the ordinary from the perspective of an acquirer, right? And so you really do. And this is actually pretty hard, you know, as a company, an early stage company, they're doing lots of stuff to get business, right? And so what you want to do is to get to a repeatable and predictable process to be ready to go public or to be acquired, right? And there's a lot of plumbing that goes into that. You got to have a CPQ. You got to have quote forms. You got to have SKUs. You got to have standard pricing and discounting. There's all this stuff that's in sales operations that you got to have standard approach to hiring and offer letters and people related things. You got to have a standard approach to compensation and all of that. So
you've got a very clear idea of what you need. But between the lines, I'd imagine you've been through this so many times that there must have been times where you've learned from fire. Have there been times when you've got this wrong?
You mean where something got gunked up in diligence?
Well, one of two things. Either that you went through a diligence process and then actually it was really painful and you said, never again, I'm going to do this early. or potentially, like, you knew it was coming, but because of other demands on your time, because CFOs and your responsibilities are so broad, that you left it too late.
It's never perfect. Each one has got its challenges. Yeah, I've been in situations where we didn't get a deal done, but then we got another deal done down the road. I think the key there is making sure you have really, really good people around you and at the company that will do well in diligence, both they're presenting, but also supporting us in finance, pulling together the information we need for diligence. So having a really great legal resource is key. Really great HR is key. Really great sales ops is key. So you're never going to have everything. The repository is never going to be perfectly ready. Every request list is different. But, you know, if you're 80% there or 70% even, then getting it over the line, if you have the right people and the right process, can be time consuming, but less painful. Making sure that the senior team is all aligned in advance on what is expected out of a sale. IPO is different. But, you know, I think I have been in situations where the founder had different expectations on the share price than the board and the CEO, and that can be painful. But you work through it. You know, you have to work through it. And that's negotiation, and that's interpersonal dynamics come into play. So the CFO role is interesting, and one of the things I like about it is it is very much a strategic advisor to the whole team. So because of that, you're in this position where you really do want to try to get along with everyone and work well with everyone. But at the same time, you have to deliver hard messages sometimes, and you got to hold the line, and then you got to learn to resolve that. So it can be almost political in that regard, where, you know, your EQ is important as how good you are at spreadsheets, and really being able to understand the perspective of the other to get to an agreement. That is something that takes time to develop that muscle, but it's super important in this role.
You've alluded to the importance of team, and that, you know, you mentioned your direct team, but also the people around the business, and that idea of building, you know, your EQ and empathy and an understanding of the other's needs. Is that something that you try to engender within your team?
Yeah, very much so. One of the things that I like to try to do is when we're recruiting, not only for ability, but also for values and attitude. So it's aligned with the company values. Every company I've been with, great values. Like, I basically won't join a company, even if it could be a fantastic outcome, if I'm not aligned with the values. I've got to believe in the mission and the culture and the ethos. And so we recruit for that. And it's hard to do that, but I think it's very, very important. And so, you know, I believe life is too short to work with people you don't want to work with. And so we make sure that everybody on the team is aligned. And sometimes you inherit folks that are not, and you can have conversations respectful in private and see where it goes. And more often than not, it's worked out. Sometimes it hasn't. And then you part ways amicably and go. But I think that's so important. And I think the CEOs that I've worked with have all been aligned with that too, which is great. And again, I'm self-selecting for that when I think about companies.
And have there been occasions, without naming the company itself, have there been occasions where you have been engaged with the process to potentially join as CFO, and then you've recognized, actually, this doesn't feel right? They've got, as you said, values that I don't share, and so I'm going to withdraw.
Yeah, I have been. There have been a few of those. I don't remember the names, and if I did, I probably wouldn't say.
Of course. But what were those flags like? Like, what was it you recognized and you said, that's not right?
Well, I tend to request a lot of information on the company when I'm far enough into the process, almost like a mini diligence. And this tells me, are they ready for diligence, by the way, if they can provide some of the stuff that gives me a assess out on that. But some of the stuff I ask for, and, you know, I will have one-on-one conversations with each and every e-staff member to figure out what their DNA is like, and okay, what's going on here. I'll talk about what's working, what's not working. I tend to look at the opportunities along a kind of a risk spectrum, right? So where is the risk in the business? Is it product market fit? Is it market size? Is it financing risk, capital? Is it execution risk? That's the best kind of risk. Is it cultural risk? How does cultural risk show up if there's been a lot of turnover? You can see some of that in the metrics. You can see where have the priorities been in hiring? How has it gone? Where are the priorities in hiring and why? You can ask to see company handbook and values and, you know, all hands decks and things like that, which will give you a hint on that. Clearly you ask, are there any legal issues, open or past? Haven't seen too many of those. And then there's art to this and there's science to this, right? So I tend to fill out a grid when I'm looking at companies. I've got this 8x8 or whatever it is now, where I'm basically taking notes and filling it out, and that gives me some structure. And then there's also the subjective other comments. And then I will back channel, you know, with investors and other folks I know in the community, and I'll try to do back channeling on things. The truth of the matter is, it has to be pretty flagrant for me to necessarily pull myself out of a process, because I tend to want to come in and fix. So if I see potential and some issues, then I'll talk to the founder or CEO about, hey, this is what I'm seeing. Do you see the same thing? Are we aligned? And have a conversation with the person who's hiring me, right? Around what's their perspective? And just be very straight about it. Many people, if not mostly all, will want to be very transparent because they know the CFO is going to see everything anyway, right? And so it's good to partner early to see how that goes, right?
You talk about that partnership, and that partnership with the founder, who is presumably the CEO as well, is arguably the critical partnership and relationship that you have as CFO. And many, many people have spoken about the CFO being the right-hand person to the CEO, being their strategic advisor. And in many cases, especially if the CEO is either like very product orientated or maybe very external orientated, they're the ones that's helping run large swathes of the company. So how do you approach that relationship with the CEO?
Yeah, and that's been the case in my experience. Right now at Imply, the CEO, FJ, is fantastic. He's very product-oriented. He's also very astute, very sharp, and he's very good operationally and financially, especially for somebody as young as himself. But I've also been involved with the CEOs who have been basically externally focused, sales, marketing, industry, investor, right? The most important relationship for me is with the CEO. Basically, we'll work with her or him to figure out what should my priorities be, right? Because there's always too much to do. So prioritization is so important. So aligning with her or him on those priorities is a necessary first start to this, to figure out where should I be spending my time. Invariably, I'll find other things. I always meet at least weekly with the CEO one-on-one to suss this out and make sure, and things change. And so you're always tacking and moving. The other relationships that I found to be super important on eStaff, I mean, look, all of eStaff is important, but sales, I partner a lot with sales because I want to support the sales team, because oftentimes they'll need my help from a sales ops or negotiating perspective, because I like it. That's been a big partnering piece for me. And then also HR, people. People are everything when you're building a team. And so that's an important partnering function. And so sometimes these founders or CEOs they very much let me just behave like a COO, right? Okay, you deal with this stuff on the inside. I'll deal with sales and marketing, right? Or industry and, you know, analysts and money raising on the point, that sort of thing. And that tends to work out really well for me. That's a good situation for me to be in.
Many guests have commented on the increasing importance of the advisory aspect of finance as a whole. So there might have been a time where FP&A was much smaller and actually just not part of what people provided, maybe because of like maturity or the time or also the availability of data. But that move towards increasing advisory and liberating your team so they've got the time to do proper advisory and partnering is a theme. It seems as if that's something that you endorse as well.
Very much so. In fact, it's we're going through this will be our fiscal year 23 is coming up. We're on a January fiscal year end, so we're coming towards the end of our fiscal 22. As part of planning for next year, we're actually talking about this right now, is the FP&A teams at these companies tend to pick up a lot of, like, anything that's very analytical or where precision is really important, like variable compensation. Right? Like oftentimes FP&A will be doing commissions administration or, you know, bonus plan administration, because I want the dollars to be right. So to the extent that it stays centered in that function to be able to advise, and that's the fun part, is the advising and opining, what should we be doing in terms of scenarios, or, hey, if we do this, here are the implications for that. You know, having the bandwidth to think and be thoughtful, you got to build out, either you got to have software for it, or you've got to hire folks that can take on some of the more routine things. So the brain trust has the time to really, you know, think about things and partner with eStaff, work directly with eStaff. Your advisors, our customers are eStaff, right? So we want to advise and work closely with them, and not just budgets, you know, what if scenarios, and hey, what's not working? What are your pain points? Okay. And some of this might be business operations too. What systems do we need? What processes do we need? Which is now a function that is, I think, becoming more and more important at earlier stages, which would be adjunct to FP&A, but not under FP&A.
And then you mentioned that you can approach it two ways, throw more heads at it, so you can almost abstract the admin away, or like try and use software or technology to do so. What's your preferred route?
You know, in the past, it's been heads, right? And now with the preponderance of software, there seems to be more and more software coming that's more administratively oriented, whether it's HR or finance, FP&A, and not just budgeting, but basically software that's AI-based that could help us suss out trends and predict trends. Like, this is all new. So this is another reason for the BizOps function, which is, I think now it's more and more incumbent upon us to understand what technologies out there that we can apply to FP&A or accounting or HR. So it's not just throw bodies. That's the more costly way to do it. But I think where I am right now is it's probably a combination of the two. It's like, I think we need to hire some more folks right now, but then we also need to think about what software can we implement over the next 12 months that might help with raising our awareness without cranking so many spreadsheets. Yeah.
And that's actually, that's what we do at Soldo as well. Like, we're one of the, like, one piece of software that is trying to, essentially, you used the phrase, but like, liberate the brain trust so that you can partner and analyze. And one of the things that when we're talking with customers, and many guests have said the same thing, is that the selection of software and actually taking the time to figure out what you want to automate, what you want to implement, is also a huge investment, because you can only do so much and you need to really ruthlessly prioritize. And in some cases, build different skills within your team in order to analyze those problems. Is that something, again, you've come across as you've been building out your team at Imply?
Yeah, and particularly Imply, because this company is growing so fast and doing so well that it's putting pressure on the back office, right? And so we are going to be recruiting for a head of biz operations that will help with this, because it's a real challenge. This prioritization, like, I'm a big believer in no more than three priorities for a quarter. Like I like chipping away at things, and like, it also, you want to build a culture of achievement and feeling good and success, not like my list is growing and it's not getting any shorter and we can't get anything done. So it's super important to prioritize. And how do you do that? I mean, I think, again, when we think about, let's call this change management or evolution, you understand the current state, the current pain points. You think about the desired state that you want to have. And in some cases, you may not know what the appropriate desired state is because things have changed vis-a-vis software, right? But you start with what you know, and then you come up with a plan to figure out what is the recommendation that you want to come up with. And generally, you know, one thing that I like to use is RACI, like RACI planning. That will help with just making things clear and timelines and project timelines, on the project management stuff. That tends to help us organize. It's a very complex process. How do you decide, should we do a bolt-on for Greenhouse to better improve our recruiting reporting, or should we do something else that can help with tracking customer activity if we have limited bandwidth? One of the things that I've started to do more of over the last, call it 5 years, is I try to do a better job figuring out, do we have the right investments in people in the right roles? And how do I do that? As I look at benchmarks from investors, okay, companies at our stage in our space or close to it, what's their investment in G&A? What's their investment in marketing? How are we stacking up? Is percentage of revenue or percentage of ARR or something like that? How are we doing, right? And so that helps me figure out, are we understaffed or under-resourced, call it under-expensed. I don't know what this says about me, but typically I'm running a pretty lean ship, maybe overly lean. And so this year we're going to try to alleviate some of the pain and do a little more hiring. It's like, whoa, we're under it by a couple of points. It's a lot. So we could prepare to scale better and not burn people out. There's always a balance.
But that's the stereotypical thrifty CFO, right? They're right there.
Yeah, I'm cheap. I am very. You know, I'm first no, then show me yes. Right. That's why I do what I do. And I want one of the things, like, I just will flat out not approve at a plan anything, but, you know, expenses or headcount without a plan. Like, if we're thinking about expanding somewhere, or it's like, what's the plan? One-offs don't work. Like, what's the plan? So it goes back, you know, because you got to make trade-offs, right? Or at least try to.
You're really trying to build a discipline within you, the leadership team, or whoever it is that's submitting those requests. Like, this is how we operate in a thoughtful way.
You're touching on something that's always a challenge. Every company, speed with lack of discipline versus speed with discipline, right? And maybe a little less speed because you can't, you know, but you got to be thoughtful. This kind of goes back to your earlier question around, how do I evaluate opportunities, right? You can tell if there's discipline or not. and what is encouraged or not, and how are they spending money, right? You can see that. And so that's actually one of the more concrete ways for me to say, yeah, this is probably not the right place for me to come in, because I'm a big believer in discipline or structure, or, you know, and not structure for the sake of structure. You got to right size it. But myself and the CEO are the stewards of the investor money. I mean, I work for the board. They own the company. Employees own it too, but it's their company. It's their money, right? We have a job because of them. So that's the approach that I bring.
And you've taken that responsibility clearly very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we've gone through a couple of very unpredictable years. And actually, in finance, if nothing else, is obsessed with trying to predict the future and forecast. 2020 and 2021 were both tumultuous years. So looking ahead, and you're in your annual planning right now, what predictions would you have for next year that you could see, whether it's within your industry or maybe broader within the economy, of like some of the things that you're basing your plans on?
There has been a lot of volatility, call it variability. The way that I and we choose to address that with the board is to run scenarios, because you're not going to, it's very hard to get predictability at, you know, Series B, Series C stage. They're on the way. There's some, but you're on the way. We don't pretend to be able to forecast accurately, but we do try to do a range, and we do pin certain decisions to the low case scenario, if you will, so that when you're not surprised and have to go down, you're surprised and go up in terms of investment. So we'll run scenarios on ARR and bookings and burn rate and cash and all that stuff. And we'll use the low end run to kind of do the headcount planning, everything else. And okay, is things going well? I think 2022 is going to be better than 2021. I think, you know, the company's doing very, very well despite COVID and everything else. I think it's only going to get better, but I'm a wait and see kind of person. So I'm not going to recommend betting capital on stuff until we see evidence of it, right? Like leading indicator evidence of it, meaning pipeline and bookings. That's what matters. You know, we're very fortunate. We have raised a fair amount of capital, so Series C. And so it gives us the ability to kind of be judicious, right? We have plenty of runway and all that stuff. And that's the place you want to be if you're lucky enough to be there.
So you can just wait. You can wait for the right moment to put the foot down.
When do you decide it's time to invest? Like, what are the criteria? You really do want to have criteria, metrics preferably, because it avoids the, you know, food fight. But some of it can't be metrics driven. And so you prepare for it, but you don't necessarily act on it. But I think in our space, data analytics, data warehousing is phenomenal. And it's just, you know, it really does depend on the industry you're in, the sector of the industry you're in. So.
And Tony, as we draw to a close, if you were in my position and you could interview or speak with any CFO, who would you love to have a chat with? And is there one burning question that you would ask them above all others?
I don't really have a particular CFO in mind. I think if I were going to a CFO cocktail party, which sounds like all kinds of fun, I would talk to folks about how have they chosen their positions, how have things evolved, what's worked for you, what's not worked for you, what have you learned, what are the mistakes you've made, that sort of thing. I like to learn. One of the things that I would point out for the viewers or listeners is it's very important to understand the right level of information to give your board in board meetings. It's something we haven't talked about, but that's a bit of an art, especially younger CFOs. And I was guilty of this too, is you just want to give them everything, right? The 20 page supplemental deck and all the statistics to evidence, oh, I've got my act together, right? But what you really need to do is figure out what do they want to see. And what I've seen work really well is a one page tear sheet of the most important metrics. So if they saw one slide, it's this, and they got the idea of the financial state of the business. And then a couple of slides on operational stuff in your departments or what, you know, that's what your priorities are for the current quarter and last. And also I would recommend doing OKR planning. I'd probably talk to CFOs about that. You know, how do they handle investor relations? Like, what software are they using? in the administrator functions, I'd definitely go down the software path with them. Are there tools that I'm not aware of that I should be aware of? Because it's hard to keep abreast of things. Things are changing so fast, right? And we don't have the luxury of having somebody who just is like, their job is to figure out what's out there that we can use, right?
Good questions. And I think those are questions that we'll, on your behalf, certainly be asking some of the guests to follow in your footsteps. We've had some of the ability to get some of that advice from you. So it's some really sage and timely advice. So Tony, the one final question would be for anyone who is in finance and is an aspiring CFO, beyond, of course, what we've spoken about already, what advice would you have for them to help prepare them for the role?
I would say that experience in FP&A is a great path to CFO, probably more important than the accounting route. You need to be facile with accounting to be in FP&A anyway, so that's good. I think there are CFOs who have been accountants and there are CFOs that have been FP&A or operating. I tend to be the latter. So that I think that function is a natural partner to a founder or CEO. I would say this, that it's good to work for a good CFO as opposed to get the title early by joining a really early stage company because you think you need to have the title. That's actually something I did that I would do differently. Like I would go work for a great CFO first and learn, as opposed to learn from, you know, baptism by fire and experience, which is what I did, which ended up being okay, but there were some interesting times there. That would be what I would recommend.
Great advice, Tony.
Yeah.
Tony, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
You're very welcome, Ross.
One last thing. If you have a question you'd love to ask a guest, visit cfoplaybook.fm and submit your question there. This show is brought to you by Soldo, the brighter way to manage business spending and expenses. With Soldo, you can control every expense, track spend in real time, automate financial reporting, and then use those insights to fuel growth. Learn more at soldo.com.